Welcome to the Education Matters podcast. Thanks for all the nice comments and thanks to everybody who's listening. One of the things we've talked a lot about on the podcast is competency-based education and Capella's FlexPath program. And we've got a cool conversation today with Amy Leighton, who's a deputy director at the New America Foundation, focusing her time and energy on higher ed issues and adult education issues. She wrote a paper called Cracking the Credit Hour, which really set in motion a lot of the regulatory momentum supporting competency-based education and new models like the FlexPath model. And we have a good conversation about her background and her passion for adult education and why she wrote the paper and why that paper, 100 papers get released every day from different think tanks around the country, and why this one kind of was at the right moment and said the right things and had the impact that it did. I felt bad. I had a hard stop, and so we weren't able to go as deep into the conversation as I wanted, but she's agreed to come back again in the next couple months. But we talked for about 20, 25 minutes, but I could have gone for at least twice that. She's a really interesting, smart, thoughtful person, and she's got a lot to say. So I hope that you enjoy the conversation as much as I did, and I look forward to connecting with Amy again in a couple months. Amy, hello. Thank you for making time to talk this afternoon.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Are you in D.C. today?
I am in D.C. today. It is a beautiful day. How is it in Minnesota?
It is terrible. It is like 60 degrees and pouring rain for the fourth straight day in a row. I'm going to start building an ark.
Okay. Well, you know what? I said that it is beautiful here, but everybody else has been complaining because it's 85 and probably 100% humidity. So for most normal people, it's terrible here. So
yeah, but you're of Miami, right? So this is nothing.
I am. For me, it's like home.
So that's a great place to start. Let's talk about home. I want to talk about competency-based education, and I want to talk about student union record, too. And I want to talk about how you got to where you are at New America. But what is your background? You're from, were you born in South Florida?
No, I guess it's a long answer to the question. I'm sort of from everywhere. I'm a military brat. So I was born in Southern California. And then I grew up in Europe, in England and Germany. And then when I was 11, my family moved back to the U.S. and I moved to Miami. My dad was in the Air Force. And we moved to Homestead, where there was a big Air Force base before it was destroyed by Hurricane Andrew in the early 90s.
Ah, and you just stayed in Miami because it's wonderful. And why would anyone ever leave?
Well, yeah, I'm not an idiot. I'm blonde, but I'm not dumb. So I stayed in Miami. I stayed in Florida through college. I did undergrad. I went to Miami-Dade Community College to get my associate degree. And then I transferred to a public four-year college in Florida that's really, really small. At the time, there were 500 students. Now it's ginormous. There are 800 students. It's a little school called New College of Florida. And then in terms of education, I later went to the University of California at Berkeley to do my master's in public policy. But in between undergrad and grad school, I lived in Paris. I did Teach for America in New York. And then I moved out to the Bay Area in California to go to grad school and do a lot around poverty policy.
I want to real quickly take a detour on Teach for America. I didn't know that you had done that. What drew you to Teach for America? And a lot of Capella's learners are in our education program. What lessons did you draw from your experience with TFA?
So many lessons. It was one of the most incredible experiences I've had. Not saying one of the most fun experiences I've had, but certainly one of the most incredible and life-changing. I taught in Washington Heights, New York, which at the time, and I think still is predominantly Dominican. So you had a mix in the school. You had predominantly immigrants from the Caribbean. And then also the area bordered the South Bronx, where you have a high concentration of African-American students. And so almost all of my students were poor. I think there were 1,400 students in my school. It was K through 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all but 7, if I'm remembering correctly, were on free or reduced lunch.
Huh.
And those 7 were, like most of them were teachers' kids.
Yep, yep.
So really poor school, very urban school. Lots and lots of language issues and all sorts of things. And so my experience with that, I came away certainly thinking that, education writ large was more important than ever. But the thing that sort of changed for me in doing Teach for America was I decided that I wanted to focus not for the rest of my career, for some portion of my career at least, not on the kids themselves, but on their parents, because I saw so many parents, who were incredible, incredible people who were doing everything they could to try to figure out how to support their kids, but they weren't making enough to make ends meet, so they had to work two or three jobs in order to put food on the table. And it seemed to me that poverty was really an issue that was affecting my kids and their ability to learn and their ability to have the types of environments that were going to help them succeed. So I sort of wanted to focus on adult poverty, basically my kids' parents. I mean, I had so many parents who came to me during parent-teacher conference who would sort of preemptively cut me off and say, I know I need to spend more time with, the Adita, but I work three jobs just so that she can eat and have a place to live. And what was I going to say to that? No. So it was from that I then decided that I wanted to focus my attention on working, on working adults.
And did that take you into the public policy world?
Absolutely. So then I decided, let me do public policy. How can you affect these issues at a sort of a larger scale? And I didn't end up doing education for a while. I focused, education, oddly ordinarily defined. I worked on legislation in San Francisco, for example, that helped to raise the minimum wage for the city. So we were the first major city in America to have our own minimum wage. And now it's sort of everywhere. LA just passed a $15 an hour minimum wage. San Francisco was the first big city, and it came out of work that I did in graduate school. I worked with an economist and did basically surveyed businesses and ran some economic models to see how a minimum wage of varying increments would affect both the workers and the businesses. Out of that, the city council decided that they wanted to pass this legislation, and then I ended up working for the city council member who authored the legislation, and then I worked to both write it and then to implement it, and it was awesome. It was a great time. And then from there, I worked with a labor think tank and worked on some sort of poverty policies.
What was your pathway then to the Department of Education and to the work you're doing now at New America?
It is a great question. So I'd been doing all this sort of poverty-related stuff and working adult stuff. And then I had a detour, sort of went back to Miami and was working at the University of Miami. And I had never really wanted to work in Washington, D.C., even though it's sort of a natural place for policy types to go.
Yeah.
I'd had a few opportunities to work on the Hill, working for a senator, working for a congresswoman in a leadership position. And I thought, I don't want to work in D.C. It's a bunch of hacks. People are crazy. I like working in cities and doing this sort of thing. But then when the 2008 elections came around, it seemed like, I sort of, like many people in the country, not all people, but many people in the country, was sort of, caught up in this moment. And it seemed like there was a new administration. There was this sort of energy. And I thought, you know what? If not now, when?
Sure.
And so I sort of threw my hat in the ring for I wanted to work at the Department of Labor because, again, I wanted to focus on working adults. And I got this call, and I was sort of not trying too hard. I just sort of put my name in and knew somebody who knew somebody. But I didn't really follow up. I didn't sort of pound the pavement. I didn't move to D.C., and I knew a lot of people who were doing that. I just sort of thought, if it happens, it happens. And I got a call from the Education Department, and I thought, this is interesting. I would have thought it would have been Department of Labor, mm-hmm. but maybe they saw Teach for America on my background. And, I sort of thought, it's so important. K-12 education is so important, but I really want to focus on adults. But who's going to turn down a call from the White House office to come out for an interview? So came out, and they basically said, look, we're looking for somebody who can help support our work on the intersection of higher education and the workforce, somebody who can focus on community colleges. I'd gone to community college, somebody who can help try to figure out how to integrate some of our policies on the workforce side with our higher education side. And the people who I would be working for, I just instantly felt a great connection to. So it seemed like the work was perfectly aligned to things that I cared about. The people I was going to work with and for seemed wonderful. And it seemed like there was this new moment. With any new administration, you have new energy, there's new momentum. And so I thought, let's try it. And it's been a great ride ever since.
So, and then you moved over to New America. We met a little bit before you released what I think has become kind of a seminal paper around competency-based education called Cracking the Credit Hour. Talk about why you wrote that. What in your experience at the Department of Education led you to that issue of competency-based education and kind of what has flowed from that paper after it came out?
Sure. So, it's interesting. There were a bunch of things happening at once, and I don't know if I sort of realize that they would all come together in this paper and end up being, you know, I think the paper, it just sort of was out there at the right time. You know, I mean, I think all this stuff was in the
it's not just the
ecosystem.
It's not just flattery to tell you this, but I mean, papers get released every day, right? And they just kind of float off into the ether. And that became one that really did help shape and change a public dialogue.
I mean, it's funny because I think, I mean, so much of what is in that paper is sort of chronicling already known history and chronicling some existing efforts that folks have been doing to help make education for working adults, I mean, part of it around working adults and making it more flexible and creating alternate pathways. A lot of that stuff is sort of out there. I think it, you know, I don't think there was much in there that was new. I think it really was just at the right time. And I feel like the thing that is, not that it was new, but the thing that I think I brought out that hadn't really been out there in the ecosystem as much with some of this really nitty-gritty federal policy stuff, which was actually the reason that I wanted to write the paper to begin with. So I was at the department when the department was doing a lot of, they were regulating on a lot of different things. And one of the things that they were regulating on was the definition of the credit hour. Mm-hmm. And to be clear, I was not actually in those conversations. That wasn't sort of in my portfolio of work, but I saw it, you know, sort of from the sideline, like that was happening. And what I remembered when I was in the department was that the department was trying to craft a definition of the credit hour that was both simultaneously like strict enough that it would prevent bad actors from, you know, mm-hmm. basically charging for a lot of credits without giving students a lot in return for it,
yep.
while also allowing for flexibility. So not, you know, not making everybody have to sit through material they already know and not, you know, allowing for alternative programs such as the ones that you offer, Capella. So, you know, again, the conversations that I sort of heard in the hallway, that was what the department thought it did. And then when I left the department, I got out and, you know, into the real world. I mean, I couldn't hear enough from people about how that regulation did the exact opposite and how that regulation was absolutely antithetical to innovation and to competency-based education. And I was saying, no, the department was trying to do this. And so I ended up really digging into that history, but then digging into the history of the credit hour itself, and then digging into some of the federal regulations and laws around, you know, what is an education, what is distance education, et cetera, and was, you know, and sort of found, again, you know, I wasn't the only one who knew about them, but it wasn't out in the, you know, it was sort of wasn't out there in the world, these sort of provisions that the U.S. Department of Education could use right now to try to help competency-based efforts. And so I think the piece, Cracking the Credit Hour, tried to tie together sort of this overarching sort of history of the crazy history of the credit hour, which had nothing to do with student learning and was all about trying to give faculties pensions, which I had no idea. It was fascinating. And then with this sort of in the weeds regulatory history, with some history of colleges that were, you know, had been trying for decades to help students who aren't the 18-year-olds going to college at a campus, you know, and staying in the dorms and all of that, and just sort of weaved it all together. And again, I think it just happened to be the right place, the right time, where there's such a demand and you have so many students who are looking for skills and looking, but they're coming to college with a lot of skills already and they want and should have credit for that, with colleges who are trying to meet those needs and politicians and policymakers on both sides of the aisle who are trying to meet those needs too. And I think this just sort of, you know, gave everybody a place to sort of focus and say, oh, you know, here are some of the issues and here's what we could be doing to help make them better. So again, right time, right place, have been really lucky, and I feel fortunate to be part of this conversation.
Where do you think all of this is headed, right? So for the last 24 months, there's been a lot of kind of public conversation around competency-based education, and it was kind of the flavor of the month for a year. And now it's kind of been mainstreamed in the sense that conversation about it is not new. Right. Where do you think over the next 2 years, not just conversation, but practice around competency-based education heads?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to go in a bunch of different directions. And I think some of it's going to be good, some of it's going to be meh, and some of it can be dangerous.
Yep.
So, you know, when I first started, when Cracking the Credit Hour came out like 3 years ago now, there were some folks who were doing basically a scan of colleges and universities to see who out there was trying to offer a competency-based education program. You know, not just a course here, a course there, but these full programs. And it was a handful. I mean, it was really like a, you know, like a dozen, maybe a dozen schools. And now you have like almost 300 schools who are talking about doing these full programs. And you have countless more who are talking about doing bits and pieces of it. And then you have non-colleges and universities. You have independent, like, businesses who are trying to figure out how they can offer these, you know, these programs and these skills that students want. Not as much now, I guess, but maybe a year and a half ago, it felt like multiple times a week I was getting calls from these investors who were trying to figure out, you know, is competency-based education the new big thing and how do we invest in it?
Yep.
And now I think it is very much a part of, it's not just sort of the early adopters now. I think lots and lots of colleges and universities are talking about it. I mean, you have some of the big schools, you have Wisconsin, you have Purdue, Michigan, who are creating these programs, community colleges who are creating these programs. And I think some of them are really, I mean, many of them are doing really innovative work. I think where I think some of it is a little less than exciting is I think because competency-based education is sort of a new hot thing, I think people want to brand themselves as competency, even if they're not. So you're seeing a lot of window dressing and people basically just repackaging what they already have and calling it competency. And then on the other end, like the what I think is dangerous is, especially if the federal policy changes to allow for even more people to, you know, players, institutions, different providers to come into this space and get some of the $150 billion a year that the federal government gives out every year in federal financial aid. I think if we don't have a better sense of what we mean by competencies and what the quality assurance mechanism is, I can see us just giving away a lot of money to folks who aren't necessarily trying to serve students well. Again, I'm not saying that I think that will be the majority. I'm not saying that that's going to be everyone at all. But I think that that is certainly a danger and something that those of us who really care about this work need to be careful about going forward. And it's hard, right? Because we spend all this time, like I find myself now, you know, like 3 years ago, it was like, we need to do this, and the federal government should be using this authority and that authority, and why are you doing it? And just sort of pounding the doors. And now I'm getting invited into all these meetings with policymakers, and I think they expect me to be the rah-rah cheerleader. But they're so rah-rah that I'm finding myself saying, wait a minute, slow down, and sort of being the voice of caution.
Well, I think you're right that so it's easy to get wrapped into the excitement, and we do it all the time here, the excitement about the potential that this holds, that this model holds, especially for adults.
Absolutely.
To move more quickly and to pay less and to end up with a set of competencies that are more applicable in their professional careers than they would get otherwise.
Absolutely.
At the same time, the worst thing that could happen is a defining down of standards and quality such that instead of creating this new category, you create a substandard second tier category.
Yep.
That instead of giving employers more fidelity around the actual competencies that someone can bring to the table, stands as a second class degree. And I think it behooves everybody who cares about this to work to make sure that those standards are high. I could talk about this forever, as you know.
Yeah, me too.
You've been really generous with your time. Talk real quickly about some of the other work that you're involved with, because this is just as important, on student unit records. I have a point of view on this that is, until you get actionable, real hard data, it's hard to make substantive change. And we exist in an environment where outcomes are poorly, if at all, measured. And this is an important step towards changing that. Talk about what you're doing on student unit records.
Student unit record is one of the most boring sounding, you know, names possible. And in some circles, it's sort of toxic. But it's basically the idea, I mean, to me, it all comes down to the fact that higher education has never been more important nor more expensive. And it's more expensive for students, for taxpayers, you know, for policymakers, it's for everyone. The costs are going up, and you have to have, at this point, I mean, you basically have to have post-secondary education in order to access and stay in the middle class. So that's so important. It doesn't, it's crazy. As important as it is, we cannot answer basic questions like, are students from this college graduating? Are Pell students from this college graduating? If you go to this particular college, what are your chances of graduating? Or are you likely to graduate? Or are you likely to not finish and to be saddled with $30,000 in debt and no way to pay it back because you don't have a degree. Does this particular institution serve Pell Grant students well or Hispanic students well? I mean, we could know those answers pretty readily because the data are already there.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this crazy law that was passed in 2008 that basically prohibits the federal government from using existing data and allowing these existing data sources to talk to each other to answer those questions. So everybody is shooting in the dark when it comes to college outcomes. So here we are saying it's so important, but we're not going to tell you, like it's important generally, but you could make a really bad decision in terms of where you go.
Yep.
But we're not going to arm you with the information to help you make that decision. And
it's ridiculous to try and make thoughtful, constructive policy without that kind of data.
Absolutely. What's so crazy is you always hear, I mean, Congress is always talking about, wanting better data and we should know outcomes. Like they're always talking about it, but they themselves are the ones who passed this law that basically makes it impossible for us to figure out the answers to those questions. The good news is that the tides may be turning and you're seeing some bipartisan support. It's not, huge at this point, but I think you see some real leaders in both parties coming out in support of better data and this boring-sounding student unit record system. So on the Senate side, that includes the sort of privacy hawk and Democrat Ron Wyden, and you have Republican presidential candidate Marco Rubio both supporting this legislation, and there are others. And then on the House side, you have Congressman Paul Ryan and some other. He's the most prominent, but you have some prominent members of the Republican Party as well as Democrats supporting this legislation as well. So, and a few years ago, again, this law passed in 2008, so it's not that long ago that it passed, but you're starting to see folks say, wait a minute, we all deserve to know, what these outcomes are because we can't make good decisions either as students and families or as policymakers without the data.
Or as institutions, right?
What's that?
Oh, I said, or as institutions.
Absolutely, and I think that's another interesting thing is you see all of the big associations. So Washington, we love our associations. Everybody has an association that represents somebody else. And the associations that represent all of the public colleges, from the two-year colleges to the four-year colleges, they all support this because it would help them be able to know their value, help them be able to market themselves. Institutions are really interested in this information too. I mean, I've heard from countless institutional researchers who say, all of our time is just spent complying with this really burdensome sort of data reporting, and we could go all into that, but we don't actually have the time or the data to try to figure out how we're doing with particular student groups so that we can do a better job. Like, we would love to free up our time to actually figure out how we're serving students and how we can serve them better. A student unit record system would help them do that. A lot of community colleges face, I mean, these folks are really doing the Lord's work. They are serving students with really different goals, students who are trying to transfer, students who are just coming in for a few classes, students who are trying to do short-term training and go into the workforce, and community colleges are trying to figure out how they can measure all of those different student successes, and they're required to measure them in certain cases by the federal government. So on the one hand, the Department of Labor, you have community colleges operate under they receive some funding from the Department of Labor, and so they have to provide some information to the Department of Labor. But the information that they could easily get and then turn over to the Department of Labor is prohibited by the Department of Education.
Yep.
So then colleges have to do this crazy workaround to try to comply with federal law because another federal law makes it harder for them to do that. So with all of the college's interest in both how their students are doing and in reducing burden, it's not at all surprising that most of the big associations are supporting this move.
I could talk to you about this for a long time. I apologize. I've got a hard stop that I need to run to. So, would you mind if we jumped on the phone in a couple months and picked this up and with wherever the world
definitely
looks in the fall? Cool.
Definitely. This was fun.
Amy, thank you for making time for doing this, and I look forward to seeing you later this week.
All right. See you soon. All right. Safe travels.
Take care. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.